Welcome to the Cybersecurity Defenders Podcast. Every Friday, Lima Charlie hosts Defender Fridays, a 30-minute live fireside chat hosted by our founder, Maxime Lamothe-Brassard, who sits down with an industry expert and hands-on practitioner for an unfiltered conversation on a topic related to cybersecurity defense. These chats are so insightful, it made sense to share them on the podcast as well, 1 week after they originally aired. If you'd like to join us live, you can register at limacharlie.io/defender-fridays. And a reminder, this podcast is brought to you by Lima Charlie, maker of the SecOps Cloud Platform, infrastructure for security operations where everything is built API first. You can think of it as a backend for your MSSP that enables you to scale with confidence as your business grows. You can get started today for free at limacharlie.io. Now let's get into it. Welcome everybody to Defender Fridays. My name is Christopher Luft and I am filling in for Maxime Lamothe-Brassard today, who is currently down at DEF CON. For those of you that may not have joined before, Defender Fridays is a weekly segment where we sit down and chat with all kinds of interesting people from around the industry, usually on the defensive side. There's so much cool stuff going on in cybersecurity, and we're just trying to shine some light into the different corners. These talks are not scripted, there are no slide decks, and everybody's encouraged to participate. This week, we're being joined by Dr. Mike Saylor. Mike, do you want to go ahead and start by introducing yourself?
Sure. I'm the CEO for Black Swan Cybersecurity. I'm also the executive director for the U.S. Cyber Defense Center, a nonprofit that helps students get hands-on experience to get the job when they graduate with their degree or from high school. And I'm also very heavily involved in North Texas Higher Ed Advisory Councils. I'm also helping a college build a bachelor's degree in cybersecurity. So cyber workforce development is very, very focused passion of mine. It's actually what I did my doctorate case study on. I've been in cyber IT for over 30 years. I've seen a lot, I've helped a lot. Just happy to be a resource and tell stories.
What inspires you to do that work? I think it's awesome that you're doing it. I'm curious what drives that.
So I didn't have much help growing up. I always knew I wanted to do something technical, computers, science, math, all that stuff. Just kind of gravitated towards computers, did some intelligence work right out of high school. And then it just kind of grew from there, but nobody really helped me develop a career path or really understand what the opportunities are. Well, at the same time, my mother and my father, great, great parent leaders, but both also educators in their own way. My dad was retired essentially as a master chief from the Navy. My mom was a college professor. So very collaborative home environment, very helpful, and even out in the community. So coming out of high school, doing some intelligence work and going to school at the same time and thinking that I needed to go to school for a cyber degree. But really, again, no direction. So I changed my degree from an engineering degree to more of a business science degree because I was also very entrepreneurial. I've had 5 cyber companies. But then along the way, also became a professor. So this is my 26th year teaching college level, university level computer science and cyber with the mix of other stuff. But along the way, seeing that excitement in especially the freshmen, you know, they get into a cyber program and really not even understanding what cyber is or where it's going to go and thinking they're going to graduate and have this high paying, great job. And so over the years, figuring out how to communicate with them and mentor them and align that. That's one of the reasons I started the nonprofit 15 years ago, is recruiting all of my students into this intern program that's then paired with community organizations that can mentor these students and give them direction. But also, as you get to know them, it's a good career path, right? So I already know you, I'd rather hire somebody I know. But I've also built 2 cybersecurity companies that way. Those students that became employees because we grew them ourselves and they came up in with the quality and the skills that we needed. And then everybody else, we tried to help find a home and, network them out on LinkedIn or however we could. So just over the years, I've been a hiring manager, not being able to find the right people. I've been a job seeker, not being able to find a job that lines up with who I am. I've been an educator that's seen both sides of that. And so all that kind of just culminated a few years ago into my pursuit of a doctorate and now trying to build some programs and synergies and standards, at least in my area of operation.
Oh, that's awesome. That's really great. And the whole country becomes stronger and better because of it, right? Yeah. So the topic you brought with you today is the importance of trusted ecosystems and incident response. Do you want to maybe get us started there by defining what you mean?
Sure. Well, there's a couple of parts of that. So if you've not thought of the incidents that could happen to you, whether personally or as a business, and this does translate, across the line. Personally, have you ever thought about what you're going to do when your identity's stolen? Because it's going to happen if it hasn't happened already. Similarly, well, what happens if you're a company and you experience an incident? And that could be anything. I mean, and I've been through a ton. Like I've responded to an incident where a squirrel caught on fire in the middle of a data center wall because it bit into an electrical line. Well, who the heck plans for that? Well, in more general terms, you could have. It's essentially a fire in a power outage. The what started it can vary quite drastically as the squirrel did. But all right, so just brainstorming, what are the significant things that could impact us? What are those risks? And then what would we do if it did happen? So there's those tabletop type exercises where we play that stuff out. Well, the important part of that tabletop exercise are those aha moments and the realization that you don't have the time, the resources, the skills, the equipment, the tools, the advice that you might need to be successful. And so one of the things that we see a lot are people doing the check boxes. I have an IR plan, I did the tabletop, and that's it, because the requirement isn't the remediation part. The requirement is, do you have a plan and do you test it? That's it. So people stop there. But what we see quite often, and we do incident response a lot, is that is truly where people stop. They don't go out and build this ecosystem, and I'm calling it that because it truly is. It's not, your house is within an ecosystem, and your house is what you run day to day, but you know where the hospital is, you know where the police department is, you know how to get a hold of, the company that comes and turns the water off or the electric. You know all this stuff, because you've thought about that where you live. You thought about your house. Some people don't know where to go turn the water off if a pipe breaks, but you'll figure that out pretty quick. And maybe you know who to call, and that's a part of it. So it's not that you've got all the answers. It's that you've put some forethought to, how do I connect with the things I need so that I can eventually have the answers, and definitely more timely and effectively than if I didn't put the forethought into it.
And when you speak about trust, are you talking about like tools and partners and some of those people you call?
Right. So similarly, let's say a storm came through town, and you've got a leak in your roof. Man, that's who do I call? Well, you're going to search for roof repair people, and you don't know them from the next guy. So you're just going to make phone calls, and hopefully someone's available. Hopefully they sound like they've got good customer service, and there's somebody you want to work with. But who knows who actually shows up, and the quality of work that they're going to do, or how much they're going to charge you, or if it's covered by your insurance company. So it's all that stuff that's going to take time in your response. So if you wait till something bad happens, just imagine what that roof repair scenario. What if it happens in the middle of the night? No one's answering the phone till tomorrow. And then, all right, so you get up and you start doing your research and you start making phone calls. How long does that take? And then what's the likelihood that somebody that you like is available and come out and fix it quickly? And so if you're figuring all that stuff out the day that something bad happens, you're already behind. And who knows what that hole in the roof, bad weather's still coming through, the damage it's going to cause. So to truly be effective and efficient in responding to an incident, you've got to get all that stuff out of the way up front. And there are a lot of organizations that'll work with you today. Like, there's law firms that will do $0 retainers. Let's get the deconfliction out of the way. Let's get all the paperwork out of the way. Sign an agreement that says if there's a problem, that you're already known. You already know who they are, they already know who you are, and we can start the clock as soon as you call. And similarly, there's incident response companies, cyber IT response, for extra hands and skills to rebuild computers and networks, or stand up in an alternate location if your facility's damaged. Get all that stuff out. Find those people today. I wish there was an Angie's List for cyber. I don't think there is. But figure out who you want to work with, what their terms are, the resources they can bring to bear, and get all that, NDA and contract agreements, MSAs, whatever it might be, pay a retainer if there is one, so that you can truly hit the ground running the moment you've got an incident you need help with.
So basically you're saying start with those tabletop exercises, but run it all the way out to the end, make the phone calls, get the contract signed and have it all ready to go.
So yeah, your first one is where you're going to start to identify where you're missing stuff. Our ecosystem is not fully built out. So the end of the result of your first tabletop and maybe even subsequent ones, you're going to start to identify the things that you need to add. Cause every year your scenario should be somewhat different. So you're not just going through the same steps every year. All right. So tabletop's done. We've got to address these things. Let's reach out and figure out who we want to work with. Add that to the plan. Well, next year, and in similar situations, invite those people to your tabletop. A lot of times they'll do it at no extra cost. Because they're invested in helping you when something bad does happen. So call your local FBI or Secret Service office. They will send somebody to participate for free, and they may even bring donuts and coffee to your tabletop. Call your insurance broker or your insurance company. They will participate. Call your internal and external legal counsel. They will participate. Call your service providers. Make it as real as possible. And there are companies like ours that will moderate a tabletop exercise. So, let us build the scenario. Let us, role play and game play and throw the monkey wrenches in and capture all the notes and aha moments. It's well worth it. And it's, even in that scenario, you're only talking a few thousand dollars, like 20. It's not expensive. And it's mm-hmm. The value is huge, because as you work with more people that are part of others' ecosystems, they bring that advice and experience of, well, hey, I understand you're missing this piece of your ecosystem. Here's a list of people we trust and we've worked with. And that is just mm-hmm. a much better way of going about it than just Google searching somebody to call.
Yeah. And what's that ounce of sweat will save a liter of blood?
Absolutely. Yep.
So how do you vet vendors and responders to make sure they're trustworthy? Trust seems to be central to all of this.
Absolutely. That's a core characteristic or principle in cyber, but definitely incident response. You want to make sure that, you're injured and the ambulance shows up. You don't want, your EMT to be day one on the job if you're bleeding out. So there's a couple of ways to go about it. Talk to your insurance company. A lot of times they've already got pre-vetted and preferred vendors that's a zero drag approach, because with your insurance company, especially, there's a lot to talk about here. So if there's an incident, do I report it? Do I report it to my insurance? It's kind of like a car accident. If you got a little ding, do I make a claim for that because it doesn't meet my deductible? Probably mm-hmm. not. Well, if you've got an incident, it's going to take you a little while to figure out what happened and what's the impact. Well, what if the impact isn't as much as the deductible for your insurance company? Well, so some companies take that approach and they try to fix it themselves. Well, at the end of the day, that $5,000 incident that they did not report to their insurance company because it didn't meet their deductible eventually was probably $10,000 or $15,000 with all the labor and time and resources they put into it, in addition to the actual or the initial impact of that incident. So at the end of the day, it did exceed their deductible. They didn't think it was going to go that way. And now they're like, wow, man, I wish we would have filed a claim. Well, it's too late. Or it's not too late, but now your insurance company is like, well, why didn't you report this sooner? And you've got a ding on your next year's renewal because the controls and the governance aren't there. And so they've got less trust in you. But call your insurance company and say today and say, how would we work with you if we had an incident? And believe it or not, unlike auto insurance, they want you to call them regardless if you're going to file a claim, because their business is reducing risk, right? So the more risky you are, that's what drives your premium. So if you can be ahead of that and work collaboratively with them and be open to asking for advice and for help, you are less of a risk to them. And so call them as often, and they want you to, as often as you think you need to, but especially if you think there's an incident, regardless of impact. They have been through everything that you can think of, and they can give you advice without it impacting their opinion of you or your premiums, and more than likely it's going to make them feel better about working with you if you're open to talking with them and working with them. So if you have an incident, call your insurance company. Insurance company is going to go, I think we should do this. And here's a list of companies we work with that are already approved. And if you use them, they're already approved on your claim for reimbursement. But if you use a third party, you should get pre-approval from your insurance company before doing so, because if you file a claim, they may not reimburse you for those expenses. So yeah, insurance company is a great way to go.
I was going to say, and because they're financially motivated, you know that their partners are well vetted because it turns into their bottom line eventually.
Yep.
Yeah.
So that ecosystem is critical, and it's a great networking. It's so not just incidents, but now you've got people you can ping throughout the year for whatever reason. And you want to get to know them and be on that kind of, that open communication basis.
I hate to have to ask this, but it's sort of top of mind, especially with the ChatGPT-5 coming out yesterday. Has AI changed a conversation around trust positively or negatively in incident response?
No. AI has been very helpful. And there's different sides to that. If I was the victim and I had was going to use AI to figure things out, if I'm familiar with AI, I know how to prompt it. I know the grain of salt that I need to take with its responses. But at the same time, I'm emotional at the moment because this thing just happened. So I may be more likely to trust what it says without that, without less salt, or with less salt. And then on the actual responder side, we use AI a lot to dig through tons of data. I mean, if you can imagine, if it's a network breach or ransomware or something where bad guys have been in there for a while and we're reviewing all this log data, we bring tools to bear, but then those tools, they're focused on certain things without the ability to do a whole lot of just true ad hoc, curious threat hunting type stuff. So AI allows us to chew on a ton of data looking for patterns and things. So again, getting ahead of the incident, it's all the way around. It's not just the victim. It's also all the responders. We've got to be more familiar with the tools and techniques that are available to us, so that if we're going to use AI in an incident response we got today and we're not familiar with it, we probably won't use it. But if I am familiar with it and how it can be applied, then absolutely I'm going to use AI. Well, then you got the bad guys using AI. And there's any number of threat scenarios that even during an incident response that they can throw out. But one of the uses of AI that we've seen is we actually did a tabletop with a large engineering company. I think it was like August of 1 year, and this last year, and identified a lot of opportunities for improvement, things they needed to do. And the CIO kept saying, let's just assume we have that and move on. Which don't ever take that approach during a tabletop. You need to dig into the things you're missing. But at the end of the day, they had this fairly extensive list of things they needed to improve, and some of them were pretty critical. And they did not take any action on that for several months. Well, then in October, they got hit with ransomware, which would have been mitigated to some degree by all the things that we suggested that they improve on. But what had happened was bad guys had been in their environment way before the tabletop exercise, and they were using, they had deployed AI agents to collect specific pieces of information and do reconnaissance across this environment, including how much insurance they have, what are their financials, how is their data repository architected, which was proprietary to them, which was pretty interesting. Like, how did bad guys know how to compromise that? Well, it turns out that they were doing quite a bit of reconnaissance and collection for a period of time before they decided to take action on their attack campaign. So it took almost 10 weeks for them to recover from that. And I think the initial ransom was $7 million. Working with a negotiator over the weekend, we got it down to six. The company was like, "How in the world are we going to pay six?" Well, they didn't even know how much insurance coverage they had. They had six. They thought they only had three. But someone in the room said, oh, we've got another $3 million policy. Well, the bad guys knew that. So they were negotiating down to a known palatable amount. Yeah. So the client thought they were making good headway and bad guys were just waiting to play that card.
It's like when you try and sell something, you sell it for a little more than what you expect to get, so you can negotiate it down and everybody feels good about it, right?
Yep.
Yeah, somebody in the chat pointed out too that trust gets eroded in this era of like deepfakes and stuff like that. I'm sure you see some of that in your practice as well.
Absolutely. Face-to-face is critical in critical situations. You know, second best is, you know, video, you know, Zoom, Teams, whatever. But even in, so in higher ed, we're seeing a lot of bots, believe it or not, executing scams for financial aid. So bots are signing, you know, they're stealing identities or just simply pretending to be a student that can pass admissions to sign up for courses to collect financial aid for these online courses. And that's billions of dollars already in just the past 2 years. And so a lot of schools now, if you're going to school online and maybe some of y'all have experienced this in your first week of class, you have to have a one-on-one video call with your professor where you show your government issued ID or passport or what have you to prove that you're a real person. And if you don't do that, they kick you out of the course and your financial aid.
Wow. Is there a specific point in the response life cycle where trust is most critical? You know, we have detection, containment, communications, recovery.
Man, it's that initial point, because I've been on several where I've come into the incident response situation and the CIO was a little apprehensive. He's not the one. He thought he had it under control, and that's fine to have that opinion if it's true. But even if you have it all under control, you're so focused on putting the fire out, you don't have the extra bandwidth to deal with management or the board or third parties. So it is important, even to some degree, to have a third party that's kind of objective and can see everything and collect information and consolidate, report, and communicate. So that first, you know, the initiation from a third party perspective, you know, if you're handed on all the internal, that level of trust, if you haven't established that, then you're already off the bad foot. But if a third party is coming in, that initial kickoff is very important, not just from a trust, but also truly defining roles, responsibilities, and expectations. Because what will also happen in incident response is, you know, if my job was XYZ on a day-to-day basis, during an incident response, some professional, third party, whatever, may have a part of that responsibility. And if I maintain ownership of that, then I'm getting in the way. And so on day one of an incident response, we've got to revisit that RACI diagram in your incident response plan and make it and cater it to whatever today's incident is, because maybe you've never been through that before and that RACI diagram looked good on paper, but you're bringing in someone that's been through that. So let's revisit that. Let's set the tempo and define who's doing what and the expectation, because a lot of times those plans are, we provide periodic updates to management. Management does not like that. Management wants to know when they're going to get that next update. So you establish all of those things. And in doing so, you not only kind of present your credibility, but now you've kind of instilled, based on what you've just defined, that level of trust. They trust that we're going to give them an update at 2:00. They trust that these people are responsible for these things. They trust that, you know, we've got this, we've been through this before and everything's going to be all right. I've even had that engineering company I spoke of, the board called me and said, so this event happened on Thursday afternoon. Well, one day later, almost 24 hours later, Friday afternoon, the board calls me and says, I mean, do we have the right people? Are our employees, do we need to fire people? I mean, it's been a whole day. How come we haven't made more progress?
Yeah.
And so you give them the, well, listen, it's evolving, and very rarely does an incident like this get resolved in 24 hours. We're still trying to figure out how it happened while some of the team is putting out the fire. And so, I mean, that's a great indication of trust when the board calls you and asks for your opinion. Well, then the operations team is now, that reinforces the trust with them, because you're being objective and you're bringing your experience to the conversation, so that you're not saying, oh yeah, I mean, if you had a team of veterans, this would have been knocked out already. That doesn't help anybody. So yeah, it goes, it's all the way around, and it really happens in that first couple of hours to a day or two. That's really important.
Have you seen any really creative or unconventional approaches to building trust that maybe others could learn from?
You know, the tabletop exercise is a great way to start to get to know your third party, your ecosystem. And it's also a great way to figure out if the people that are going to come and help you are a good fit for your environment. We've seen that where, you know, we were moderating a tabletop and they brought in their third party, which they got all the agreements and everything done, but they've never had to work with them before. So this is their first opportunity to work with the representative from that company, and that they just didn't fit. There were a lot of things I won't get into, but, you know, they're sitting at the table. People didn't want to sit by this person. Their interaction wasn't as professional as you would expect. And so at the end of the day, they were like, we need to look for another partner for this. And so I think that's one of the things that's often overlooked as well. We're so focused on the skills and the technical abilities of people to help us put the fire out. We don't consider the impact that person would have in our environment working with our other people. Because if nobody wants to work with that person, you're already down. You know, that's diminishing your effectiveness. And so that goes back to, you know, let's get to know our partners and our ecosystem as soon as possible, so that when something bad happens, we're all on the same page and can work together.
Yeah, and those things can be fun too, right? Like you said earlier, you bring the coffee and the donuts and make a day of it. Yeah. So we're getting pretty close here, I guess. Is there anything in the audience, anything you can share with the audience that they could do to start strengthening inside their own organizations? You know, we talked about tabletop exercises. Is there anything else?
Well, first, so in your incident response plan, you should have a responsibilities matrix, or a RACI diagram, responsible, accountable, consulted, and informed. That's what RACI stands for. And so depending on the situation, and I guess backing up a bit, so you should have a business impact analysis done on your entire organization. If you don't know what that is, that's, you know, we can cover that another time. But the business impact analysis helps your organization understand the critical functions, the technology and processes and people that support those functions, and the impact if that function is at risk or unavailable. All right, so that BIA is typically what feeds your disaster recovery plan, your business continuity plan. But that BIA also identifies all the stakeholders, the owners of the process, the owners of a department, the critical people. So when you build your incident response plan, you should, so you've got your minimum incident response plan. It says, you know, we will do XYZ if something bad happens, and we know who's responsible and that kind of thing. But more granularly, you should identify the threats to your organization that are going to have the biggest impact. A loss, you know, someone stole a laptop that's got 300 years of client data on it. That's pretty important, especially if you do business in California. If you are a regulated industry like healthcare or banking, what are the threats to you? Is it ransomware? Is it compromise? Is it financial transactions? Whatever it is, you need to build a specific playbook for that threat. If we got hit with ransomware, how would we find out? How would someone report it? How do we handle it, escalate it, validate it? How do we stop it from spreading? And then
who do we
along
call?
along those lines of procedures, you identify all the resources in your ecosystem that need to come to bear to satisfy that. Well, at the bottom or somewhere in this, you identify all those players. Is it Mike? Is it Bob? Is it Sue? Is it the lawyers? Is it the FBI? And where along the playbook do their responsibilities come into play or change? So FBI could be consulted or informed, legal counsel consulted, informed, except maybe they're also accountable for reporting to legal, you know, regulatory entities. Whose job is that? Is that compliance? Is it legal? So get all that out of the way so that we're not figuring out who's on first and, you know, who's doing what, for these, and it will likely change from one playbook to another. So all that can be done fairly quickly, especially in an environment that's good at and able to talk to each other. You know, you like, to some degree, you like who you work with. They can be knocked out pretty quick.
Awesome. Awesome, Mike. This was super educational. I really enjoyed the conversation. If folks on the call are interested in reaching out to you, what's the best way to get in touch?
855 Black Swan, BLK Swan is our 24-hour number. My email is msaylor, S-A-Y-L-O-R, at blackswancybersecurity.com. I'm also on LinkedIn and Twitter. Twitter is at Prof Saylor. I'd give out my cell phone number, but I don't answer
it. Don't do that.
Call, but go to voicemail.
Yeah, awesome. Really appreciate it, Mike.
Certainly.
And that brings us to the end of another Defender Fridays discussion. Support our show by sharing your favorite episodes with a friend. Subscribe or give us a rating on whatever podcast platform you're listening from. If you want to be a part of the conversation and join us live, you can register at limacharlie.io/defender-fridays. Thanks for listening in, and we'll see you in the next one. The Cybersecurity Defenders podcast is hosted and produced by Christopher Luft. The show is co-produced and edited by Sam Blake with graphics by Amr Al-Khatib. Sponsored by Lima Charlie, scalable infrastructure for your security services. Visit limacharlie.io to get started for free.